Our speaker for today needs no introduction, and we're proud to have him again start off our lecture series, Dean Lovelock.
Thanks, Marsha. I admire all of you for getting here fast enough to get your lunches. That's great. So, munch away. Munch away and drink away, and I will do my very, very best, despite my enthusiasm for this topic, to stop in time for questions or discussions, and by the time that comes, you should be done eating so you can speak up. So the topic for today is about groups and experts. And thinking about groups is something that a number of people at this law school have been working on over the last few years, and I will refer to some of that work. And so let's start with groups, and then I'll show you where I'm going with what I think the future will bring in terms of experts. And by the way, some of you may have read things about this. There's a popular book out now called The Wisdom of Crowds that touches on some of this. There is some literature on this. If you're familiar with it or you've met it in class, then just keep eating and don't pay attention. And I'll modulate my voice so you know what's new. So here we go, for starters. You probably know, or you should know, that modern technology has brought about an improved ability to run markets, or, here's the key phrase, to aggregate dispersed information. So all of you know much more than you realize, so to speak. I'll count myself as one of you. We're used to this with markets, right? I mean, 20 years ago, a very famous study showed that the futures market for oranges was a better predictor of the weather than the National Weather Service was. That's kind of the whole first half of my talk, so let's just dwell on that example for a minute, and then I'll give a more mundane one. First, I'll say it optimistically and then skeptically. Again, the optimism is you have experts, you have weather predictors, they're doing their best, they have fancy computer models at Princeton and elsewhere, they can copy what the European weather models are doing. So there's this whole science industry of meteorology that's building up to predict the weather. Then there are private people in the market that can make money buying and selling oranges. If there's going to be a frost in the wrong season, price of oranges will rise, you know, and so forth and so on. Now, of course, there's no acoustic separation. It'd be sort of fun if those people were not allowed to know what the National Weather Service said was to be predicted. But the National Weather Service is famous for its predictions 1 to 3 days later. It's not really well known for its one-month predictions. And indeed, it's not really well known for its one-day predictions, but that's a separate subject. It does its best predicting one day. It does predict 1 month ahead. So if you watch, well, how does the market that cares about the weather, how does it predict the weather? How does the National Weather Service predict the weather? Well, wow, it turned out that the market was doing a better job than the National Weather Service. That might be interesting. Let me just be skeptical about it for a minute. It might also be bogus. One way to think about it is that the guy who did the study, Richard Roll, is his name, R-O-L-L, pretty well-known economist, had the advantage of looking backwards. Right? There are many, many markets that are based on weather, many, many markets that are based on other phenomena that experts study. And in a sense, what you'd want to do is go see 100 markets that are based on weather and 100 and compare each of them to how the National Weather Service is doing. And if it turned out that only 3 of them were beating the National Weather Service, then that could be random. Right? I mean, it could be that you have to go backwards and look for an example. So that may not be a very good test. Well, now roll the clock forward 15 years. Many of you have seen, maybe even participated, in the famous IEM, or Iowa Electronics Market. That's a good modern example of a more explicit information market. How many people have ever bought shares or sold shares in the IEM? Oh, the rest of you are missing a great pleasure in life. You make money or lose money?
I made a little bit.
You made a little bit. Good. Well, that's great. So there's this market out there run by the University of Iowa Business School. It has Securities and Exchange Commission clearance and all that, in case you're worried about being a felon. And the basic idea there was people could buy and sell shares. In the old days, it was, what percentage of the vote do you think the Democratic nominee or the Republican nominee would get in November? Now it is just who do you think the winner will be? And then you know, the more, say it's 60%, if the market thinks it's 60% likely that John Kerry will win the election, then you would expect it to be cheaper to buy Bush shares, so to speak, and more expensive to buy Kerry shares. And so by watching the price of the market, you can see the probability with which the market thinks that a given candidate will win the election. More things are traded on the Iowa exchange market. There's also a big market out of Ireland called tradesports.com that some of you have probably visited. It's a much less impressive market for a lot of reasons, but I don't want to go there right now. And just to give you an example of its failures, so there was a big market in who would be President Bush's first nominee, that is after O'Connor announced her resignation. And Roberts was in there, but so was Gonzalez, and so were, you know, people you've never heard of, and, you know, nobody, there was no big winner, so to speak. It's not as if I could say the market knew it would be Roberts, and it was Roberts. Instead, the market was all over the place. If the White House leaked that it wanted a woman, then Edith Jones' stock went up. So, again, it, you know, this is just a matter of what information is out there, and it's not so magical that it's going to find information that isn't out there, so to speak. And probably thousands of people playing these markets didn't really know who George Bush was going to pick. Though thousands of people out there might be much, much better at figuring out who will win the election in November than any one political columnist, let's say. So to compare results, the IEM became famous because its ability to predict the winner of the presidential election, even looking backwards, compared to oranges, was matched by no one. Not a single political writer, not a single columnist of any sort, not a single magazine, not a single show. It's even better than that. No Gallup poll, Harris poll, no London predictor. No one beat the IEM, even with the advantage of hindsight. So even now, when we go back, the IEM turned out to finish first anyone could look at it. And it did this election after election after election. You could limit, it was limited how much money you could make. I think when you played it, it might have been $500 or something. There's a limit to how much money you could make, but it was a market. Hollywood.com has also been in the news. I try not to dwell on these, though they're amazing, one after the other. Hollywood.com is like playing Monopoly. You try to predict the box office receipts of movies that open over the weekend. I guess if I stand here, that microphone isn't going to do much good. You try to predict box office receipts. You try to predict the winner of the Academy Awards. And again, as has famously been shown, Hollywood.com out-predicted any magazine's predictor of the Oscar winners year after year after year after year. And it does very, very well predicting box office receipts on opening weekends. And there's no money to be made. It's purely points. It's bragging rights. But some insider in Hollywood who spends a lot of time studying this can say, your name is there on Hollywood.com. Oh, I'm the biggest point leader in Hollywood.com. These are obnoxious, arrogant, boasting people. Has anyone played that one? Have you really? Oh, how'd you do?
Okay.
Great. Ah, go ahead. Just brag. I mean, no, no, get away. Yeah, oh, I saw your name there in third place. Wow, that was fantastic. Yeah. So, okay. These, again, you got the idea. These are so-called information markets that you might think of things where thousands of people aggregating their knowledge, either by just voting or by playing the market, would be better. And you could see the idea, right? For some things, a vote would be good. You might have tried this in class. If I say, how many miles is it from Chicago to New Orleans? We could go around and everybody could put in a guess. Some of you may be expert. There might be people here from New Orleans, and they might be a little bit better at it, having driven it a few times. Maybe, you know, Mr. McNally from the Atlas Company would be here. We might think, whoa, that guy really knows this stuff. Maybe he would do it. I mean, there might be a real expert who knows it exactly. You know, I don't mean that the group is always better than the expert. But I'll think of somebody who's from New Orleans as sort of an expert. Well, it turns out that the entire class, if everybody guesses, the entire classroom, if everybody guessed the number and was not trying to sabotage it, I might say, for example, I'll give you $100 if you get it exactly on the nose. And that might give you enough of incentive to try to guess the right number. I gave a version of this talk in Cleveland not so long ago, and there was a skeptical professor in the audience, and she said, oh, I went to my class and tried it out with them. It was the distance from Cleveland to L.A. or something. I've tried this many times, and the group is fantastic. And she said she tried it, and the group was way off, she said, 128 miles off. I predicted they would be within 10 miles. She later sent me the email from the group. Well, you know, one person in the group had guessed 20,000 miles, another person in the group had guessed 30,000 miles. So, I mean, if you had just taken away those two people, the group actually would have been really, really, really good. So you've got to do something to keep people from making these crazy guesses. Anyway, the group does really well. IEM has done well. Hollywood.com without money beats everyone. I guess that the more, just to be theoretical about it, the more you think that it's not what you know, but it's what you can invest in knowing that matters, then the more you need a market, right? You might bet on how many miles are from here to New Orleans. You might be good at it. The statistical mean or the median guess of the room is what will be fantastic at it. A version of the Condorcet jury theorem for those of you that have dabbled in this literature at all. But if I want you to think about weather forecasting, I want you to guess the price of orange juice next year, then I probably have to have substantial money out there for you to win, because you would invest in learning about the weather and about oranges. And so, for example, if before this, if the poster had said, Lovejoy's going to name two cities, anybody that can get the distance between those two cities exactly right is going to get a $100 prize, some of you would have spent some time, and I've been to the trivia contest, and you guys don't memorize anything. Some people would have memorized, you know, how many miles it is between, say, 70 or 80 pairs of cities, and I might have asked one you knew, I might have not, it might have been worth it. And so the more there are prizes, and if I had said there's a market in it, well, then you can first hear the problem, and then go spend money trying to measure the distance, and then presumably the market would be very, very, very successful. Okay. That's the general idea of these information markets. By the way, I was going to say about Roberts. So it didn't do very well on guessing Roberts. I mean, it was susceptible to White House clues. But amazingly enough, tradesports.com got exactly right Roberts' age. That is, it did predict that the age of the Supreme Court justice, one category, was 50 to 51 years of age. And it did get that exactly right. I don't know what you want to make of it. It's one trivial little bit of hindsight. But that's, you know, sort of impressive, I think. Anyway, you don't need to be impressed by markets. You've come to the right law school for that. Probably I have to convince you that people could ever be wrong. But, you know, votes, some money rewards, some markets, probably increasing degrees of correctness. Now, the market itself is not fail to notice this. So there are companies now, Hewlett-Packard is the best known of these, there are companies that have begun to make decisions based on these information markets. We might do admissions this way next year, you never know. It's not crazy, as you'll see in a moment. So here's Hewlett-Packard, let's do a real example. They want to know how many of their new printers to construct in factories. Now, how many factories should be converted to produce the model 4650 printer? So they go to the regional sales managers and they say, how many units are you thinking of selling in California? How many do you think you'll sell in New York? How many in Massachusetts? Well, what do we think about people's ability to answer that question? You know, on the one hand, the sales manager wants to give a high number because you want to make sure that when you have units to sell, the units are there for you to sell so you can get your commission. You don't want them to underproduce. On the other hand, if you give too high a number and then you only sell half that number, they might fire you and say, what a lousy sales manager. Couldn't even meet half of her goal. So they might balance a little bit, though there's no reason to think it'll wash and get exactly right. And so they do their best, they ask questions, they take some surveys, they try to predict, they make printers. Hewlett-Packard said, well, people have these biases, let's create an internal market. So create a website, again, it's much easier once the internet's up and running, create a website, give people passwords. They didn't want people from IBM playing on a Hewlett-Packard website. More on that in a minute. Be careful. Might not be such a bad idea to do that. But more on that in a minute. And so they have a couple hundred people at Hewlett-Packard, the guys in the factory, the salespeople out on the floor, and they can buy and sell shares. A little bit of tax and other issues. They award prizes. If you get more points than anybody else, you get a free trip to Hawaii. Second most points, a trip to Bermuda. Third most, a trip to Cleveland. I mean, whatever it is. And they, you know, offer some prizes. It's a little bit of a market. So successful, Hewlett-Packard is reported now to essentially have ditched the regional sales marketing. You know, no need to hire predictors when the group has aggregate information that does a very good job of predicting things. Again, these are people with knowledge. They know about the inventory. They know about the product and the like. This may be some danger of sabotage. Even within Hewlett-Packard, if the prize is big enough, it's a, you know, all Hewlett-Packard computers you want and free trips anywhere in the world, you can imagine sales going very well, and some, you know, guy thinking, oh boy, I'm almost going to win, but the sales are going to be too high. You can imagine that guy, you know, going to some Office Depot and, you know, breaking some Hewlett Packards on purpose in order to drop sales. Or, you know, why be shy about it? Go shoot people who buy Hewlett Packards. And, you know, so you got to be careful in constructing this. That's an interesting example because that's worse than sabotaging the market. If you go to the market and you sell the shares, so to speak, you sell short the 46.50, there might be other people who think, Tommy is a little nervous that the sales figures are too high. He's trying to lose, you know, get the prize by convincing us that it's going to go down. The more he sells short, the more I'll buy. You know, you can offset his sabotage. Just like the people who might be trying to make General Motors stock go up or down, the market isn't generally fooled by that. But this is the worst kind of sabotage, right? If you blow up the actual computers or shoot people who are buying them, that's not so easy to offset. That's probably a net social loss, you know, killing a few people along the way. So that's a little bit of a problem, and you might want to take steps to guard against. Again, by the way, I want to point out, that is a problem in the current market as well. If the sales manager thinks that his job is on the line, if sales aren't that high, you know, I'll kill you unless you buy a Hewlett Packard. I mean, that's not unknown behavior, though perhaps not by Hewlett Packard. All right. I need one more example before getting to where I think we want to go as a legal matter. So Cam Sunstein is right. And by the way, one of the great experts on these markets is our visiting professor, Michael Abramowitz. That's how I first met him. We were both interested in this topic. And he is a big fan of information markets, and I'll get to one of his examples later. Our own Cass Sunstein has a book coming out about this, in which he too is impressed with these information markets, and I think he rather ingeniously sees that we could think of blogs as a version of information markets. And I want to talk about that for a minute. By the way, no good law professor would ever give a talk without advertising his own law school. Notice how I already dropped in a little pro-Abramowitz, pro-Sunstein things. I was going to say he has a fantastic book coming out. I have some copies for sale in here. But then you know that already. A book by Sunstein, it is fantastic. And I've read it in draft. It's a really great book. So he sees this idea that my advertising was going to be, starting Monday morning, we're starting a University of Chicago Law School faculty blog. And every week, a couple different faculty members will post things for discussion. So, like, opening up roundtable discussions in the community. So, you should, I encourage you to participate in. I think the first blogs will be about the Roberts nomination, and about post-Katrina relief, and a couple other topics. Well, anyway, how was that ad? Was it convincing? Yeah, a free trip to Hawaii doesn't make the best comment on the blog. But I will be the sole judge of that. And then I will put in some blogs myself, but you know, feel free to, you know, think whatever you want about the comments. So Cass really got me thinking about this, about blogging, right? You see the idea that, you know, the dumb example is somebody posts a blog and lots of people comment, no, you got your facts wrong, right? But blogs themselves aggregate information. We have got some examples out there of where people are blogging in a way that fixes politicians, you know, fixes their errors, so to speak. But you can even think of it as democracy itself. I'll start slowly because that's a grand idea. So I hope that most people have experienced Wikipedia. Wikipedia users? Anybody who doesn't know what Wikipedia is, don't be shy. Wow, my heart goes out to you. Actually, the other way around, I envy you. And then you're about to have one of the greatest experiences of your life. No, if you don't know that Wikipedia is great, you're just spoiled. I mean, Wikipedia is a user-driven encyclopedia on the internet. So you go, and you're thinking of going to a city, and you want to learn about it. Instead of looking at Britannica, or just doing a Google search, you go to Wikipedia, it's sort of a version of Google searching, in a way. Because under Chicago, under Berlin, under scissors, you know, when were scissors invented? Everybody yell out what year they think scissors were invented. One, two, three, go. One, two, three. The average was really great. So that question came up in my family at the dinner table. How old are scissors? You go to Wikipedia, different people, and you know, oh, if there was no entry, somebody might start an entry on Wikipedia. But there is an entry, and you, the very first time you go visit, you can modify the site. You see a mistake on it, scissors are spelled wrong, or you think it should be scissors are spelled wrong, it could be a grammatical error, you can go change it. There's a little cookie kind of thing in there, so that if you can identify as somebody who always goofs, you know, you're a saboteur, so to speak, then they can remove you from the ability to edit it. But that happens rarely. Most people, you know, who cares? You know, who has an interest in spending their time screwing up Wikipedia? I mean, probably there's a potential would have some interest in their time. But they don't seem to do it. That might be a crime or something. I don't know. And besides, they probably like ideas, or they probably copy Wikipedia, right? Just like people playing IM like the Gallup poll, right? It's a competitor, but they can use the Gallup poll, you know, and so forth. So you go to Wikipedia, you look up scissors, somebody has made an entry about scissors. Oh, the first scissors appeared in, there's a reference of early French history. And somebody else says, no, you know, I'm an expert in Chinese history. You go, and they go, oh, in early China, there was a thing, there was this. Someone figured out some tax. By the way, that test has started. Somebody figured out taking two knives and connecting them. And technology is all about how you connect them, you know, not. And, you know, the article on Wikipedia on the history of scissors is the best article on scissors I could find. I mean, it's really, really great. And why should it be great, right? It's got hundreds of people who can go do research if they want. They can use other experts, or they can use the experience of groups, or they have dispersed knowledge. I know about China, you know about France, he knows about knife technology and sharpening. Together, we can produce a really fantastic article about scissors. It's user-driven to the nth degree, and it evolves. I have tried, I'm embarrassed to admit, putting a couple errors in Wikipedia to see what happens. So I went to look up conversatory theorem, mentioned earlier. Pretty good entry in Wikipedia, and I first added to it a little bit, and somebody else added to it. Then I went back a week later and I put in an error. Afraid that I would get banned from the site. A week later somebody had added to my error, unfortunately. But two weeks later, my error was gone. Someone had gone in who also cared about the subject and removed the error. And, you know, I mean, the site was really fantastic. And the entry on voting systems in Wikipedia, WIKI, Wiki is the software that enables this, is really terrific. There's another site called Everything Too, users. By the way, Wikipedia, English, French, German, appears in lots of languages. Wikipedia English, I don't remember the exact number now. I think there are roughly 100,000 regular users, meaning people who are altering. So that's a lot of people contributing to this encyclopedia. 70,000 in French. You know, it's a small market and so forth. It might be much more than 100,000. I can't remember right now. But it's really great. Everything, too, is an expert version of Wikipedia. It's the same idea, but you earn points. The more expert you are and the more it can be shown that you do a great job, then the more powerful you are at entering and changing the site. I'm surprised you're laughing. I would have thought that's the sort of thing most of you would intuit. Most of us would intuit was a good thing. Anybody can go on Wikipedia? You know, my aunt, Perna, who's kind of an idiot, can go on Wikipedia. I mean, she'll just botch it up. No. Let her prove her worth first by putting in some good signs and sticking to the subject you know. Then you'll get her point. Then she'll become more powerful. Well, go judge for yourself. I think Wikipedia is dramatically better than Everything Too. Now, it's cheating a little bit because a lot of Everything Too is just cutting and pasting Wikipedia. But that's what knowledge is. that is how we do things. So, you know, that's not really so terrible. Everything Too is edgier. Everybody thinks they're being funny. Are you an Everything Too user? You used to be. Yeah, I saw your country there. I don't like it as much. But it's worth comparing them because you could see the heavy hand of the expert in Everything Too trying to personalize the experience. And, you know, for most subjects, you might want to go to both of them. I mean, it's not that hard to go to both, just as you might look things up in Grolier's and Britannica both or something of the sort. All right, I need to zip forward because I want to get some thoughts from you. So let me just tie into law a little bit. So I once wrote this article called Taxes and Ballots. Some of you may be familiar with it, and that seems to be kind of an example of this. But I didn't realize it was at the time. My claim there was that one way to think of our tax system, the charitable deduction that lies within it, is that it's an ingenious example of aggregation. aggregate dispersed information. Right? So to some degree, our government gives out money. It might decide to fund that symphony orchestra or the rebuilding of that city or the space program. But it doesn't. It might not be very good at knowing which women's shelter is really good, or even which local hospital is good. It might be good at knowing what approach to cancer research wants. So it might have an NIH out there, but it might not be very good at knowing locally which shelters do a good job, or you know, and so forth. So think about what it does. It says if you donate money to a 501c3 organization, we'll essentially match your contribution. It's not perfect. You have to make enough money to file tax return and get a charitable donation. It's not a perfect voting system. But if you just said, all in favor of giving money to shelter A rather than shelter B, you know, shelter A would be in this horrible, inefficient business of getting their friends, vote for A in ignorance. You've got the some advantage, as we saw in the weather example, of putting your money where your mouth is. So basically, says, if you're willing to give $50 to shelter A, we'll give you a tax deduction, and that $50 will only cost you $20 or $25, let's say. You can think of that as a method of gathering dispersed information. Your taxes are balanced. But they are your way of voting with the government. A lot of collective action problems. Maybe we want to give more money to Greece and less to Turkey, or the other way around as a society. It's very hard to get that right, because once you know how much money the government's giving to Greece by majority vote of the Congress, that might make you more or less inclined to donate money of your own to charities that mostly invest in, say, Greek hospitals, invest with a small eye in Greek hospitals and so forth. But for many, many things where there is local information, like hospitals, like shelters, and so forth, thinking of taxes, thinking of our laws, taking dispersed information into account, is probably not a bad idea. So compare all this to experts, right? You already see my first claim that we should think that our legal system is already moving in this direction even before the fantastic ability of the internet to gather this information. So sticking with the shelter example, letting lots of people donate money and then having the government match it may well be better than having a central authority that received applications from women's shelters all over the state or all over the country and then decided where to dole out the money. Different people might have different views about this. One is more subject to lobbying. On the other hand, one is more subject to rich people giving money. I mean, there are all sorts of issues going on. But it's not crazy to imagine that you'd want your government to give out money, maybe not all of it, but at least a good part of it, through this dispersed decision-making. And that's, as I say, even pre-internet technology. If you had a way of doing this that would take the experience of all the people who used multiple shelters into account, you know, you have now been to several shelters, which one served you best at lowest cost? I mean, that might be very good if you could figure out ways of constructing a market. Not so impossible, by the way. You might want to have a vote of those people and then have a market that you made money if you could predict how those people would vote. You see that idea? In other words, even if the knowledge is in the hands of people who aren't going to play the market because they don't have the money or something, or they have other things to do with their time, that's okay. The oranges didn't vote either. You know, the clouds didn't vote. If you can have a market about these other things, and then you can have people developing knowledge about, well, how will poor people say they're being better served? You know, you got to be really imaginative about how these markets could develop. For some things in life, you'd expect markets not to work at all. You know, say an example I have used in class. I apologize if anyone has been in that experience, but you know, I'm not feeling well, I'm feeling fine. Well, I would say I wasn't feeling well, I go to my doctor goes, you should go see Dr. So-and-so, and I go there, and on the door it says, you know, world's leading brain surgeon or something. One of the world's leading brain surgeons, I got problems. And I go in there, and they do, you know, scans and all that, and the guy says, you know, by Thursday, you need brain surgery, it's life or death, you really got to have this, you know, life-threatening brain surgery, or you'll die. And then, you know, everybody says, get a second opinion. By the way, I should have started on this topic because second opinion isn't the point, really, right? If you go get the second opinion and the second opinion disagrees with the first, you're going to have to go get a third opinion, I guess. So I think when they say you go get a second opinion, they mean be prepared to get three opinions. I need to know a little math there, but I'm not going to do that today, right? You might think if you're ahead of me, which I hope you are, why would three opinions be better than one? I mean, the three opinions might be a 2-1 vote. And that's just really taking the surgery amount on the basis of a single vote. Why is 2-1 better than 1-0? But if you've ever taken statistics and thought about pulling socks out of a drawer, then maybe you could solve this problem. 2-1 is better than 1-0. But we'll have to talk about that another time. Or be so nerdy as to ask about it in the questions and answers, and I'll be happy to explain it to you. But you see, oh, and of course we could take a 1,000 expert poll, but presumably that's expensive and I don't have time for that, because I need to know on Thursday whether you've got the surgery. So here's my claim about that. For some things, we sense that experts really know things. We are unlikely to be able to read CAT scans and know whether I should get brain surgery. If there was enough money in it, we would. Right? We could hire experts, or we could get good at reading them, or we could get good at which experts are good at which things. I mean, that's presumably what it means to be a good client. So that in the long run, I think that experts are going to give way to information markets. That's really, I think, the point that's coming out of all this work, right? In the long run, whatever our equilibrium is now between when you believe in votes, asking a bunch of people, when you believe in your own intuition, your friends, lots and lots of people who can make some money on it with awards, lots of people who can make a lot of money on it through markets, those are kind of increasing degrees of distance from you, but this ability to gather dispersed information, versus spend all your money on going to a law firm to get advice, so spend all your money on neurosurgeons to get advice. I think it's, we're in for a big shift. I think we're in for a shift from the expert to the dispersed information, precisely because of the development of these markets, or you might say because of the technology of gathering information from many, many people who can learn a lot, right? You're really knowledgeable, powerful people by being able to search the internet and do this and do that. You can acquire information about scissors in China and all that. That's probably making you a better market player and a better voter. Abramowitz has suggested that this is all happening to lawsuits. So that, take an extreme case, maybe we need not have much litigation at all. Once a year, something could go to the Seventh Circuit. Because the idea might be that, you know, Microsoft sues AT&T or something, and they start deposing witnesses, and right away, the market cares a lot about what will happen in that lawsuit, and it could be quite a refined market. Instead of just seeing how they do in the stock market, which is influenced by many things, it could be a narrow market in that lawsuit, okay? Who thinks that in that lawsuit, Microsoft will win more than $83 million? You could have a binary vote up or down. I just picked that because it would make it look exactly like Iowa. You could also have a market at $85 million, $89 million, zero. You could have lots of markets, though they might get thin if you divide the question too much. But maybe not. And over time, Microsoft and AT&T might even say to each other, why litigate? I mean, the group knows what's going to happen. They're following the changes of opinion in Easterbrook Composer's mind. They know what's going to happen in this lawsuit and how the rules of evidence are going to change. If the market is fantastic, you just file the suit, wait a day, look at the market and say, oh, the market thinks that our claim isn't worth much. It's worth $275 million. Okay, here it is. That's a lot cheaper than going to litigate the case. Okay, once in a while, we'd actually need to let the Seventh Circuit decide a case so that the market would have information about evolving legal standards. Plus, that would overcome sabotage. But it might be that Microsoft, knowing that AT&T loves these markets, might influence the market as if the lawsuit was really going to be successful. And AT&T would have to know to call their bluff, though there could be another market about whether that's a bluff or not. Well, we laugh, but that's what options markets are, right? That's how cotton and tobacco are bought and sold. It's people figuring out what's a bluff and what's not a bluff, and that market works awfully, awfully well. Even Hollywood.com does better, by the way. And so over time, rather than going to, you know, Wachtell, I choose Wachtell because I guess they're sponsoring this CBI, so we should be, I am grateful for that. A lot of their business isn't giving advice. And it might be, I feel certain that Wachtell will move with the times very well. But in our present arena, one of the things they do so well is give advice about what's likely to happen if you carry through with the lawsuits. Right? That might save you lots and lots of money by knowing how to settle the suit now. Over time, the market might do that better than any expert. It might be that thousands of people who went to law school or who worked at law firms or who worked at other law firms, who have inside scoops at other law firms, or who know what really happened between Microsoft and AT&T, it might be that that market will give even better advice than one of the great law firms in the country can give. It doesn't mean that law firms go out of business. There's plenty else they can do. No doubt they'll bring suits against the markets for how the markets are operating and so forth.
they do will shift a little bit because their expertise, another way to think about it is their clients, rather than being the largest firms, might become the medium firms. Since, after all, markets are unlikely to develop about relatively middle-level firms. If people don't have that much information, if a law school sues a contractor that renovates this room, you know, it's not going to be a very thick market and people won't care. And so it may be these smaller markets that will become the clients of the experts and so forth. Anyway, that strikes me as a pretty big change down the road. And so it's the one that I thought I would point to today and the one that interests me the most right now in my own work, that we may be seeing, good as experts have become, we might be seeing the shift, it might change Daubert going out of law and all that, but I'll leave that stuff for another time. So I wanted to leave plenty of time for questions, so why don't we do that right now? Yep. How are you? Great. It was true. Thank you for asking.
What about the idea that you need experts constantly providing their expertise to make these markets work? The idea that these experts are participating in these markets and people are making judgments based on what these experts are doing and how they've been doing in the past.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat the questions, if that's okay. The question is, well, don't discount experts. I mean, these markets might only be doing well because of experts. Hollywood.com might be using what all the pundits are saying, and they're just improving it a smidgen with dispersed knowledge. You know, by the way, it could be the other way around. Could be the experts know jack. And they just follow what the markets do. You know, the weather service, they actually don't know the names of the clouds. They watch all these years. They've been watching the orange market, and then they go like, oh, it's going to rain tomorrow. I mean, why isn't that crazy? I mean, you know, the causation could be going the other way. And maybe we should monitor if it's been going the other way. By the way, that's a good example of a market that defies conception. It has been well known for 20 years that the European weather model outperforms the American weather model. Because it's annoying. what the Weather Service says is, well, but they're going to predict in European weather. And it's hard to predict American weather because the Rocky Mountains and the Gulf Stream, I mean, you can go into this. It wasn't exactly your question, I recognize. But if you were right, you know, you'd think the Weather Service would just take the European model, stick it in. We're not doing that. Right, isn't that our experience with experts? The individuals are stubborn. And they're kind of like, no, I don't want to have the same prediction yet. Markets might be able to overcome that. So I'm not so sure which way the direction is. But you're quite right. I'll put it in a more positive way. It might be that in the future, rather than Microsoft hiring the expert Wachtel, Microsoft is going to the market, but it's people playing in the market that go to hire Wachtel. But if the expert is valuable, you can make a lot of money by betting better than anybody else, and you expect to go to market. So just by shift the expertise, the location, and you could in turn change company business rules and why would Wachtel give advice? They would just play the market themselves, and that might be what hedge funds will do in the future. They will be the source of information, and that might be what governments do. That does remind me, but the grand thing I was going to say before was, one way to think about Wikipedia, if you want to be optimistic about experts, is to say, it's a user-driven encyclopedia, that should remind you of the country as a whole. I mean, isn't that sort of what our democracy is? Democracy really is, aside from the original framers doing a little bit of work, mostly the whole system evolves in a way that the group chooses to develop. It's like an ongoing project which you can modify a little bit by lobbying or voting or doing this, doing that. It doesn't mean that the role of an expert in political science or writing constitutions is useless, but it's the market itself that's hiring the expert. It's not like the political scientist reigns supreme and now the market competes. So markets have a way of using the experts. Yeah?
I guess, could you say a few words about the policy analysis market? Is that what it was called? I think it was the
terrorism thing?
The DARPA.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, how should we feel about insider trading?
So the first question is, over the last summer, I think it was a year plus ago, the Defense Department or somebody had this idea, well, you know, we want to know what's next after the World Trade Center, where should we be deploying resources? So let's have a market. People out there will bet. I hate to use the word bet because we don't think of it that way when you buy Treasury bonds, but that's a bet too. People will try to make money
guessing or investing information about, you know, what will be bombed next, so to speak. And then we, in turn, might want to deploy our resources there, though the market itself will respond to that, and there'll be some equilibrium. And, you know, the result was, you know, outrage, and you could sort of see why, because first of all, there's this horrible moral hazard that you might not have been thinking of flying a plane into the Sears Tower, but now you can not only fly a plane into the Sears Tower, which didn't really appeal to you that much, but you can make a few $1 million doing it, by, you won't either enjoy it, but that's a small problem. But you get the idea that there's moral hazard where you could profit by creating terror exactly where you had predicted terror would be, and how could the government be so stupid to be trying to create this market, blah, blah, blah. And you know, they had to withdraw and say, oh, it was just an experiment, we really weren't going to do that. So it was bad public relations, right? I mean, it's obviously not crazy. You know, one way, we don't think anything of, we would love it if we found that our Justice Department was paying informers in presumed terror cells to tell us where they thought terrorist attacks were going to be. That's a market, too, with moral hazard, right? Somebody might go into the business of being, I'll get to you. Somebody might go into the business of being a terrorist and wanted to get, you know, that's pretty far away. So, you know, that kind of moral hazard is there in markets as a whole. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I think it depends on how well you can set up the market and think that you've overcome the extra moral hazard problems that the market adds. You know, I would never set up a market in where my child is most likely to be kidnapped. I mean, I think the probability of my child being kidnapped now is extremely low. And by creating some extra economic incentive for somebody to figure out where that is, that seems to me just to create a moral hazard way out of proportion to the fact that there might be expertise that could tell me what streets to avoid. Right? I mean, there is some benefit in avoiding crime and all that, but I don't think I would use a market to do that. But again, I think we could develop expertise in doing that, and when there is a known threat, you know, one of the first examples of use of these markets was in World War II. There's a famous example, which I had this in good work, and I can't remember the name of the book all of a sudden, but I might have read it because of someone who graduated last year showed me this. Famous example of World War II, where they're trying to figure out where some enemy submarine is on the bottom. Someone else may have read about this. And sure enough, the captain on the submarine, it's not quite as good as the story tells, but the story is that the captain on the submarine created an internal market to get lots of people to think where that submarine is, and then they went to search, they took the median, and they went to search there, lo and behold, plucked it out of the deep sea. You know, a kind of amazing example of dispersed information. That's not quite what happened, but it's the same idea. It's a great market. There's no danger there that they had first put a sub there in order to find it. I mean, there's no more around it. It's a really astonishing example because these guys were going to die if they couldn't find it in the first place, so they had quite an incentive to find it anyway. That's more a matter of putting the group together to think, which I don't know really requires a market. And your other question was about?
Insider trading.
I'm one of the few people left in the world, certainly at this kind of law school, who thinks that insider trading needs to be regulated. I'm worried that the moral hazard is downward. That I'm allowed to insider trade in General Motors, and I work for General Motors. The easiest way to make money, yes, I could get information to markets faster, but the easiest way to make money would be to make a bad car on purpose and sell General Motors stock short. I would worry about that if I were General Motors. And that's why I think probably some regulation of insider trading is good as an efficiency matter. But lots of people don't agree with that, though I don't think they really address the moral hazard problem. I don't think this problem with insider trading is worse than any other. That is, take Hewlett Packard and a sales guy. I'll stick with that example. That sales guy has all sorts of misincentives, if there's such a word. And the fact that he could inside trade in his knowledge, well, other people playing the market will be aware that he could mistrade. So I think of all the places where I would worry about inside information, this is maybe the one I'd worry about at least. It's about the other way around. I mean, if you were Hewlett Packard and had a choice, have all the insiders play this game about how many units you'll sell, or have the whole world play the game but not allow the insiders to play it, you know, pick a choice. I think you would much rather the insiders play it. I would rather everybody play it. And sabotage a loan or regulation from the SEC seems the problem. I have a deal with you.
Mike has already answered.
Oh, great. Who's here? Yeah.
I think, don't you still have a need for expertise in these markets? Because you've got, like, say, for example, your brain surgery example. If you ask this room, you know, whether or not you have brain tumor after looking at CAT scan, I don't think you'd get a very accurate answer. But if you went across the street to a med school and asked a room full of med students, you know, whether or not you need brain surgery after looking at a CAT scan, you're probably going to get a much more accurate answer because they have...
After they kept me waiting 4 hours.
Right, but you need to have a baseline level of expertise right. in certain markets to be able to make predictive guesses.
Well, I don't mind that at all. I mean, I kind of don't agree with anything you said, but I agree with the bottom line. You see what I mean? Because if there were a market and it was worth a lot of people in this room would get pretty good at reading CAT scans. I agree that if I gave them out now, nobody would know anything except we have one doctor here or two. And we would rely on them instead. But the point is, if there was a lot of money made, they'd get much better at it. So you got to be a little bit more dynamic. And if presumably if there were a market, the med students would be playing that market a lot more than the law students would be playing the market. So the market itself will create expertise. These experts aren't there out of nowhere. The experts in reading CAT scans are there now precisely because there's a market for people like us wanting to know if we need surgery. It's just shifting the market a little bit and making it possible for thousands of people to look at things for a few seconds each. And sometimes 1,000 people looking at things for a few seconds each can do a better job than one person looking for 1,000 seconds. You know, that may be a way to think of it. Not always, but sometimes. There's so many studies of this. I mean, I don't know if you're a sports fan or something, but you know, if you think about should the player on first steal second in this setting with this pitcher, with this count, with this score, with this fact, it's not at all obvious that the manager is better than the market. And it's probably just a matter of time before a baseball team develops a market in doing this, a market that could be used on the spot, which would, of course, increase fans and all that. And, you know, there might then be people who would spend a lot of effort reading old Bill James abstracts and stuff in order to make money in that market. And then the manager, so to speak, who's the expert there, would just move over and live in that market there. You know, I don't mean that this is the death of experts. In the opposite, in a way. I just mean that we shouldn't think of them as you go to the expert, you go to the market, and the market might or might not be residence place for a lot of experts. Be a lot of people who would have numerous expertise. It would get rid of a lot of licensing requirements, and it's real privatization, you know, when put that way. Uh-huh.
Markets are good, and I'm a Chicago guy, I get that. But at the same time, I'm wondering where there are instances where information markets and large-scale group markets have failed, one area in general would be environmental policy, perhaps in particular something like Easter Island. And so I guess my question is, one, what are the limits of large-scale information markets? And two, it seems like in cases like environmental policy and Easter Island, participants there were willing to trade off long-term gains for short-term ones. So how do you adjust for that in a lot of these markets?
Well, that's kind of a brilliant question, though sort of funny, right? I mean, what I mean by that is, it's so Chicago, and out Chicago, Chicago. I mean, I love the conception of the problem that not knowing exactly what happened on Easter Island, but probably having read the same books you've read, you're picturing that on Easter Island, they had a market. I'm picturing that on Easter Island, they had an expert, they had some chief who said, take that tree, move that, roll this. You know, it might be that Easter Island stands for the failure of experts. I mean, there's something, just that experts in that era weren't head of the wrong discount rate or something. Or were ignorant. There's something funny about calling Easter Island the failure of a modern information market. But okay. I'm happy to know that Easter Island was a live market in Hyde Park. I mean, that's fine. I never think it's a good idea to look backwards to know, you know, a failure or a success. I mean, we want to look either at lots of epidemiological evidence backwards. You know, do democracies do well in general? The fact that one democracy may be horrible, or may torture people, may starve its population, that wouldn't on its own make us feel bad about democracy. We'd want to compare democracy to another form of government. And similarly, we want to think about a variety of ways that environmental policy might be developed, and then compare. It's very hard to do that looking back because of the selection effect and all that. So as I say, I completely agree with where you're going, that you need to be careful before you... It shouldn't be that you say, I now believe in markets for everything, because there'll be some things they do badly. Just like it shouldn't be that you'll believe in experts for everything. Or, dare I say, elitist as it will sound, most of us would say it shouldn't be the able even voters to do everything. Even though in theory it should be perfect, the voters should vote their hearts when that works, when they know that they're ignorant, they should be trusting the expert. It should be perfect to put everything to a vote. The voters should vote on the Federal Reserve policy. They might just choose to listen to Alan Greenspan. I mean, it's the same idea. Problem is we're nervous about that. And markets are either better or worse just because they give some economic incentive of putting your money where your mouth is, but they exclude some people and all that. So again, it will require experimentation. And I suspect that my only claim is that 20 years from now, I will use experts, markets, votes, and my own intuition in different proportions to the way I use them today. And my claim is that it will be more the votes and the information market because of this growth of the ability to aggregate information, and now that we're seeing how clever these markets can develop. Even that idea when I said, sort of to be funny, but not entirely, well, there'll be a market in what poor people will say they got out of a given shelter. I just sort of made that up on the spot. It's not as crazy as it sounds, but that idea never occurred to me 5 years ago. Until you see information markets work, you know, tradition would have been to say, well, you obviously can't have a market now. These are people that are, especially in down, use a market to move on to the next one. That's obviously not true. Right now we've seen you can have a market in a lot of things about what other people were doing. You know, that's in a way the genius of a lot of these things. So I'm not an advocate in general. I'm not that kind of person. I'm just a positive observer. And you know, my observation is that these are very, very interesting markets. I think we have time for two more questions before you all go back to class. Yeah.
If you know that the decision that you're betting on is going to be made based on the market that you're participating in, why do you have an incentive to vote for what you think is actually best rather than for whatever's winning at the time?
You might have to ask a follow-up. It's never obviously good to bet on what's winning at the time because that probability of winning was already taken into account in the price of the thing.
Right.
So they're not going to sell it to you at a bargain. If everybody thinks it's 81% likely that Bush is elected president, you'll pay accordingly for a share of Bush. So say your question again.
Right, but I'm not talking about betting on Bush. I'm talking about, say, what the manager's going to do in a baseball game. If you know that what the manager's decision is going to be based on the market, and, 85% of people have said the manager should do X, then the manager's going to do X. You know that already, unless there's some large influx of people coming in. So I'm just going to bet on whatever everybody else is already betting on, because I know that the manager's going to base his decision on that market.
Yes, that's interesting. So it has to be set up as a sort of series of short-term options or something. And the same thing is true with General Motors stock. Of course, there's a lot of money we've bought to be made or lost based on whether the stock goes down 1 point. The fact that it's higher than it was a week ago is still a big market in the marginal movement of the stock, and you'd need to construct the baseball market that way. Offhand, if I were doing the baseball market, I wouldn't do it on the basis of cumulative information. I mean, I promise I didn't think about that example until today, so I could probably do better if I had a day, but it's my fault for bringing it up. I think if I were going to construct that market, I wouldn't share the cumulative information. The runner would be on first, the screen would post the question of, on this pitch, should the runner go? And I wouldn't show people the ongoing tally as in a paramutual horse race, because I don't want them to do what you're saying, and I want it to be independent decision making and all that. Do you see what I mean? So I think we could avoid that problem in that particular example. But I see your point generally. It really goes back to the thinness of markets, that there are a lot of questions. You know, another way to say your question there would be, if it's something that requires a lot of investment, should we dig for oil here or should we dig for oil there? It's a big investment. In order to get people to know about that, they have to do a lot of investing in advance. It's not like you know it from childhood. And in order to get people to do that, you probably have to hold out big rewards. And to hold out big rewards, you have to have a pretty thick market out there. You can't just run on the pitch, so to speak. You have to have them, share in the big gains and the big losses. So it could be hard to set up a market like that without having cumulative information. Do you see what I mean? I'm agreeing with you at that point. So that would require some work. And you notice the irony there again. Why would the expert be any better? You know, the expert is just, again, not going to get any credit for doing what everybody else does. The expert, you need a good manager if it's correct not to bunt with the runner on first and second and the pitcher up. And the managers has an incentive to go along with the market. The market meaning what managers have been doing for the last 15 years and so forth. So I'm not sure experts are better there, but your point is very well taken. And for our last question, sure. And thank you for coming.
Well, most of the questions you brought up involved questions of fact, but suppose there were a question that didn't involve questions of fact, involved something more like moral judgment. Would you be concerned that a market there would break down, or should markets go beyond questions of fact to things more metaphysical?
Well, but that question, did everybody hear the question? These are questions of fact, and what about if it's a matter of theory or moral judgment? Is that fair? For most of these things, you're not going to like my answer. For most of these things, I don't think it's fair to characterize them as fact or theory or moral judgment. I mean, in some sense, everything is based on fact, and in some sense, nothing is based on fact. I mean, I'll give a boring example, you know. Should we rebuild New Orleans? Where is the president located? Should you have voted for Bush or for Kerry? You might think of those as quintessentially non-facts, correct? But of course they are based on facts. I mean, if all the voters knew that by voting for Bush, we would have, you know, triple GNP and solve the war and none of this and then everybody would have voted for Bush. If everybody had thought that voting for Kerry would have appealed, then they would be also. Facts are, in a sense, the stuff of preferences themselves, with rare exception. You know, you might believe in God or not believe in God, or love somebody or not love somebody, almost without mentioning underlying facts about them. But I can see that there are some. I can see that there are some things that might not be based on that. But most things are a little bit more like being in a jury room. Whether the person is innocent or guilty is based on a lot of facts and then assembling facts. And so there are moral judgments and theories involved, but they are based on facts. Like whether to get surgery or not is kind of about a fact, a set of facts, so to speak. Or likely to get surgery is good, or likely to get not. So I think that the number of things that are really based on non-fact, which is I think your category, is actually much smaller than it first seems. I think those are about preferences, I'll call them. And I think those are subject to all sorts of voting problems and voting paradoxes and the like. I don't think there's a market. And I think the market knows that already. That let's just pick a dumb example, since this is not the finish on a light note. I think the market might be very good at knowing in what volumes to produce the vanilla, chocolate, and coffee and ice cream. Because you can think about people's tastes and how they change in age and all that. I don't think that the market has anything to do with which of those three I like best. You know, that's a preference of mine. It probably is based on some fact. Probably we'll figure out that something in my genetic material or previous carnivorous experience does explain why I like coffee and ice cream. I mean, there probably is some explanation, but we're not there yet in those facts. That's just a preference. So that in turn, if there's a market on will baby Livermore, who's never had ice cream before, emerge from the womb and prefer vanilla, chocolate, coffee, ice cream? And the market will probably be pretty volatile and not really set anywhere because the market will recognize that this is a preference or a moral judgment or whatever. On the other hand, you know, markets might be good. A market, you know, a church might be very wise to use a market in trying to figure out how many priests it will attract in the next 20 years from a given region of the world. Yeah, that's a really, really important resource question for a big and rich church with a lot of decisions to make. Decision about how to handle child abuse scandals. You know, that's a really, doesn't seem like it's fact, but of course it's based on lots of facts. There's a lot of dispersed information. People who don't want to come forward with information they have about their priest or their childhood or whether they really go to church next year at the church. That'd be a fantastic subject for a large-scale information. So I think this is good news. It's a new tool for all of us, and having information is probably good. So it's fun to do the first CBI. See you at more of them. Thanks again to Octel.